American foreign policy should not be about the triumph of democracy in every quarter. We should always support free government and so forth. But like that's the George W. Bush, Woodrow Wilson Manichaeanism that has led us on the shoal so many times before. And now we're dealing with like a nuclear armed great power, and potentially we've got one, an even stronger one that we could be fighting soon.
Welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. I'm Chris Park from Johns Hopkins SAIS. Today I'm joined by my friend Alexis on this podcast. The Biden administration has defined China as the pacing challenge that poses the most comprehensive and serious challenge to U.S. national security. Sino-American tensions, in particular, have escalated due to disagreements over the future of Taiwan and the potential of Chinese invasion of the island. What should the United States be doing to prepare for a war over Taiwan? Would preparing for a war be the same as preventing war? Is the United States making sufficient investments in the Indo-Pacific to match the strategic urgency? Elbridge Colby joins us to discuss the American defense priorities in the new year and whether the war in Ukraine is a distraction for the United States.
Elbridge Colby is co-founder and principal of the Marathon Initiative, which focuses on developing strategies to prepare the United States for an era of sustained great power competition, and he is also the author of Strategy of Denial. He has previously served as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Strategy and Force Development, a role in which he led the development and rollout of the 2018 National Defense Strategy, and the Director of the Defense Program at the Center for New American Security. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Well, Mr. Colby, thank you for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks. Good to be with you guys.
As some of our listeners may know, you are the author of The Strategy of Denial, and you also were instrumental behind the 2018 National Defense Strategy under the Trump administration. In these, you argued that the United States should be directing the bulk of its resources to the Indo-Pacific. My question is, why must we make this choice? And to start off our conversation today about U.S. defense priorities in the new year, what makes the Indo-Pacific the most vital interest of the United States?
Excellent question, getting to the heart of the matter. I look at things from the standpoint of what's in the American people's long-term, interests, their security, prosperity, and liberty, which are obviously interconnected. And so, the most dangerous threat is obviously the threat of direct attack or invasion, but that's pretty unlikely for reasons we can kind of probably leave aside for now. So the biggest threat is that some power would be able to agglomerate enough power, enough strength, to be able to impose its will on the American, people and their way of life and our economy, and basically undermine our way of life. And if you look at that, I'm a realist, so that's my heuristic, my lens, in sort of the classical sense. And economic power, economic productivity is the taproot of course, national wealth, but also military power in the modern world. And in that context, Asia is by far the most important region of the world. And so, the primary interest by deduction is to deny anybody the ability, certainly an overtly hostile country like the People's Republic of China, I'm sure we'll get to, but any even plausibly hostile country or, state from dominating that much power. And so just by deduction, everything else is secondary because the prospects of that are there's so much less strength and wealth that's available there. And moreover, China is by far the most powerful state in the international system other than the United States itself, 10 times the GDP of Russia. And the trend lines are actually increasing in those directions. Asia is becoming more important. Europe's becoming less important, and so forth. So I would say, I refer to it as Asia. The Indo-Pacific, I actually have some questions about the term. But if we just understand Asia as that economic sphere, that's the most important, area in the world, and thus for the United States as well.
Could I ask about your qualms about the term Indo-Pacific? I understand the term free and open Indo-Pacific originated from the Japanese government under Prime Minister Abe in 2016, or I guess formalized in 2016. And I guess the Trump administration in 2017, as well as several other Indo-Pacific countries like Australia and recently South Korea, borrowed from the Japanese government. What does that term encompass? And is there a more precise term to refer to this region?
Well, I don't have an objection to it as a kind of a geopolitical construct. What I particularly, since we're talking about defense strategy, what I worry about is that it tends to scope out the area of concern from the Pacific, and particularly the Western Pacific and East Asia, to the broader Indian Ocean. I think that's actually a mistake, because the decisive theater is really the Western Pacific and the first island chain, basically the countries of East Asia and Southeast Asia. I mean, India is, of course, incredibly important, but it is quite far away, and there, you know, distance matters in terms of interests, in terms of the ability to project military and other forms of power. And so I prefer, when I'm talking about particularly the defense element, to talk about the Western Pacific or East Asia.
But that makes sense. It's important to prioritize. It's important to be precise about where the core interest of the United States lies. But to take a step back at this point, I wanted to see if you could give our listeners a sense of the magnitude of the present security challenges. Have we faced a peer competitor like China that can dominate a region that contains much of the global population, much of the global productive capacity? And how does today's challenges compare with the security challenges the United States confronted in the past?
Well, when you look at it by scale of GDP, the United States has not. At least we have not faced, the United States has been clearly the largest economy in the world since, I think, surpassing Great Britain in the sort of, I think, second, third, or third quarter of the 19th century, somewhere around there. So the United States was a much larger economy than Imperial Germany. The United States alone was much larger than the Axis powers. In fact, and I think this is actually very telling, Robert Kagan, in a very big essay last weekend in the Wall Street Journal, made a central error that I think undermines his whole argument by saying that actually China was weaker in GDP terms relative to the United States than the Axis powers. That's actually not true. The United States is China is much larger relative to the U.S. economy than the Axis powers were. In fact, the United States alone was larger than all three by a substantial margin, not to mention that we allied with the Soviet Union and the British Empire, among others. So, and then the Soviet Union was never, hard to know accurate figures, and the Soviets dedicated a lot of their resources to military forces, but, probably something like at most maybe 50, 60% of U.S. GDP, to be generous. So just objectively, right now in market exchange terms, you could say the Chinese economy is probably around three quarters, maybe 70%, something like that. But in purchasing power parity terms, which tends to matter more for geopolitical assessments, China may already be larger. And so that's significant, very significant. So I think in just objectively, it is unprecedented. And I think that, one of the fundamental flaws of our mindset right now is, even though we notionally say that with our lips as a corporate entity of the US policy world or whatever, we don't actually mean it.
So as you've explained for us, the United States is confronting an unprecedented challenge, and of course we are led by the Biden administration at the moment, which released their 2022 National Defense Strategy in late October. At the core of this document is the concept of integrated deterrence, which we actually had the pleasure of interviewing Dr. McInnes at CSIS about in November, but we were also wondering for your take on it. So how do you understand integrated deterrence, and do you see that concept as a useful framework to prepare our military for a conflict with China?
Well, I'll be more complimentary of the National Defense Strategy of 2022 than I will be of the concept of integrated deterrence, which candidly, I just don't think is a very useful concept. I think it's either a banality, which is to say, when you can, you should use all elements of military and national power in as integrated a way as possible. Yes, okay, but the world is full of friction and imperfection. Or it's incorrect, which is to say that hard military power is just one of several different elements of national power, and we can use other ones with just as much efficacy in the event of conflict, which I think is wrong. Actually, to their credit, I don't think that's actually what they're saying. The administration has said that they're going to have a standard of denial defense effectively along the first island chain, and Taiwan is the pacing scenario. So I've only read the unclassified version of the National Defense Strategy. So, but that's only a partial or sort of a through a glass darkly kind of situation. But from what I understand from public statements and assessments by people who have seen the classified version, there's basically, you know, just continuity, and it's in some ways a step forward. I couldn't comment in more detail, but I don't think we should focus too much on the integrated deterrence thing, because I think once this administration is over, like Secretary Austin goes, I don't think that concept will last, or I don't think it should, at least.
But one objective that, of course, will last through administrations is the objective of deterring a military conflict with China, as you've mentioned. So right. Why is defending Taiwan in the national interest of the United States in that area?
Well, people have different reasons. I look at it as critical to the cohesion and sustainment of an anti-hegemonic coalition in Asia, because it's important to narrower form of credibility than many of the sort of neoconservative or kind of liberal hawk types. I don't think everything we do matters equally, but I do think it matters a lot to countries like the Philippines, Japan, South Korea, et cetera, Vietnam, how we treat Taiwan vis-a-vis China. And that's, you know, there's a lot of these countries are just determining whether it's prudent to stand up to China alongside us, and that's going to play a huge role. So that's very important, sort of geopolitically. And then secondly, it's militarily very significant in the middle of the first island chain in containing Chinese military power. So Taiwan is important because Asia is important. Taiwan is not sufficiently important in and of itself for the United States to fight, God forbid, World War III over China. But that's never really the issue, because wars, this is a kind of Clausewitzian sort of view, but like these wars are about much more than the particular equity being fought over. So just because of the size of China and its patently clear, much, much more ambitious goals, I mean, it's building a military, it's developing, you know, basing architecture to sustain a global military presence. So it's clear that Taiwan, from our point of view, we have to bet that Taiwan is just the first step. Other people talk about democracy. I don't think it's worth large numbers of Americans dying to protect another democracy, even as much as I admire it and so forth. I genuinely, and it's capitalist system. I also don't think the semiconductors alone, I think that's a contributing factor, certainly very important, and would be a massive problem for us if we lost the TSMC and associated sort of commerce from Taiwan. But I wouldn't fight World War III just to protect TSMC. I would deal with the consequences. But again, those are sort of contributing, supporting factors that others may have a different set of or relative weighting of reasons about why we should defend Taiwan. But I do think it's critical. But I will say this: it's only worth doing if we can do it effectively and at a reasonable cost and level of risk. And that's why I'm so insistent, because it's not a binary issue. It's not a binary question, you know, zero or one, or whether we're able to defend Taiwan. It's a sort of a sliding scale of risk and capability. So, you know, the more easily we can defend Taiwan, the more readily the American people will support it. You know, if it's a close cut thing and tens of thousands of Americans are dying, people might throw up their hands. And so that's what frustrates me. For instance, Undersecretary of Defense Colin Call gave an interview yesterday that I just found really the wrong attitude, where I would describe it as a kind of blithe dismissiveness of, you know, the potential for a Chinese attack on Taiwan and whether it could succeed. And that kind of attitude, I hope it's not reflected internally. I don't think it is. I see a lot of actually even political appointees exhibiting a different attitude. I would much rather see an attitude that's like, let's make darn sure we get this right, and let's not let it even be close so China doesn't get the wrong impression. And that's a much different attitude than I saw exhibited at least recently.
You know, as we talk about building up the capability and capacity to defend Taiwan, I'm wondering how important is our declaratory policy on Taiwan? And for our listeners who want a deeper dive on this topic, we've had Dr. Zach Cooper from the American Enterprise Institute come on and discuss this topic last October. But the United States has a policy of deliberate strategic ambiguity, where it does not commit to whether or how it would defend Taiwan against a potential Chinese invasion. And of course, President Biden has signaled U.S. military commitment to defending Taiwan several times, which was then walked back by some of his advisors. But in any event, is it time for the United States to adopt strategic clarity? Or does that even matter in light of everything you just said?
capability is the most important thing, but I also think, you know, declaratory policy is relevant, but bottom line up front, I think that we should not formally abandon strategic ambiguity, but I would say we should have a policy of capital letter strategic ambiguity, which is the formal stated government policy, but a lowercase policy of strategic clarity, which is, that's where we are. I mean, the Pentagon has said it's the pacing scenario. The president said four times that he's going to defend Taiwan. There's a lot of discussions of Taiwan. So I think the Chinese understand that the United States would very likely come to Taiwan's defense. I think the Taiwanese are increasingly understand that. I think the American military increasingly understands that. But I don't see the mileage, you know, being beneficial enough to justify the provocation towards China. And I don't use provocation just as like a empirical term that would ensue from formally abandoning strategic ambiguity. So, I mean, my basic, you know, the way I generally think of it is like, we need to stop talking and beating our chests as much as we need to like hit the gym, you know, because right now we're like speaking loudly and carrying a small stick relative to the problem. And we should focus more on taking a low profile on the Taiwan political issues and symbolic issues and focus on, you know, getting stronger and readier.
To go back to something you mentioned earlier, you talked a bit about how Taiwan matters to other regional actors. So we were wondering, how do you see transformations in Australian, Japanese, or South Korean foreign policy? And how do these changes maybe inform Biden's framework? And also, what would the United States need allies to do more?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for the Biden administration, but I would say that this is evidence of two things. One is, you know, fundamentally is a greater fear of China and a greater appreciation that, in, you know, a military buildup is an essential part, or I would say the essential part, of deterring China and preventing it from becoming a regional hegemon. And I also think there's a sufficient confidence in the United States that countries are, you know, not just cutting a deal. there are voices in places like Australia, Hugh White, or in Japan that make this case. But clearly the dominant strain across successive administrations in both countries has been to kind of move towards a more collective defense model, you know, integrated with the United States. But again, that's mostly driven by just the daunting military buildup that China's undertaken over the last couple decades and its increasing assertiveness. South Korea is a bit of a different story in the sense that, you know, South Korea's security picture is first and foremost about North Korea, and for very good reason. I mean, there's a heavily, heavily militarized border along the demilitarized zone, and, you know, North Korea also has, you know, WMD and nuclear weapons and so forth. So that's sort of like consuming of most of their security and military attention. The South Koreans, I think, are certainly under the Yoon government, the relatively new government, are more in step with the U.S. and what I think of as this kind of anti-hegemonic coalition. I think South Korea will continue to, it'll be a lagging indicator, and it'll be first and foremost focused on North Korea. You know, there are elements in South Korea that seek to, you know, equivocate or maybe bandwagon with China or hedge. I just think that's a really terrible idea, even from South Korea's perspective. I mean, and I'm not South Korean, but I can give my assessment, which is the worst place to be if you're in between two superpowers or two great powers is to be neutral, because then you're a battleground. So you're best off if you're kind of, you know, on one side. And so the security perimeter applies to you. So I think the South Koreans get that. But I also think, you know, their military is largely oriented, for obvious reasons, towards the north. They don't really, you know, they don't have a lot of naval and air power that can contribute to a Taiwan fight. So I think that's kind of where that stands. And, you know, the Philippines is moving a lot under the new Marcos government. The big announcements on the basing and access for U.S. forces to you know, come into the Philippines and do operations with the Philippine Armed Forces, that's very encouraging. So things are moving in the right direction. The question is whether they're moving fast enough, and I'm skeptical.
And on the topic of South Korea and its own security challenges, what would happen in a joint Korean Peninsula and Taiwan contingency? And how do you think the U.S. as well as South Korea should prepare for such a scenario?
Well, I think we do need to be prepared, because, look, the way I think about it is if China is prepared to make the cosmic roll of the dice and start a war over Taiwan that almost certainly will involve a war with the United States, then, you know, if you've already decided to do that, then you're going to do other things that seem, you know, very, very aggressive. So, and that help you, like, for instance, creating problems for the United States by distracting it or, you know, presenting second and third fronts. So one of the most obvious would be to try to get the North Koreans to start something on the peninsula and draw U.S. forces in. So, you know, Taiwan has to be, not because Taiwan's more important than South Korea, but because you would, you know, again, Clausewitz, you make sure that you're dealing, husbanding your forces for the decisive fight, right? Like, you really got to make sure that you don't lose. If you win in the secondary theater, this is what happened to the Austrians in 1866. You know, they won against the Italians, but they lost against the Prussians, and the rest is history, unfortunately. So you got to make sure you win the big fight. And so what's critical there is that the South Koreans be prepared to take the overwhelming bulk of the conventional defense of South Korea against a North Korean attack. And of course, you know, if and when a U.S. defense of Taiwan were successful and Chinese forces were sufficiently attrited, then some U.S. forces could be swung in that context. But I think everybody's going to have to be prepared. That's why I don't, you know, I'm of the view that our alliances should be about working with countries where our interests are aligned, and don't, you know, the opposite point of view, to be a little bit flippant, I refer to it as the Three Musketeers version of alliances, which is all for one, one for all. The Dutch are going to be there with us in Taiwan. No, it's not going to happen. Like, work with countries where they have the will and the capability to do as much as possible. Well, South Korea, North Korea, Japan, Taiwan, obviously Taiwan, India, more in South Asia. Don't try to drag India into a Taiwan fight. It's just, you know, it's going to be really hard, and they're probably not going to offer that much at the end of the day. Ditto with the Europeans. Don't bother trying to drag the Europeans all the way to the Pacific for limited value. Have them focus on Europe, where they obviously care the most. So I think that's the kind of logic we should use for addressing that very real problem.
But if we go down that line, what happens to U.S. troops already deployed to different parts of this region? You know, for example, we have about, I believe, 24,000 U.S. troops stationed in South Korea right now. You know, let's say in case of a joint contingency, what happens to those troops? Should the United States make the decision to prioritize Taiwan and make South Korea respond to a North Korean invasion alone?
Yeah, I think the U.S. force posture on the peninsula should be revamped in light of the China threat. And I wrote a piece in the Korean Press a couple years ago. I mean, I think there's going to be an increasingly direct threat from China to South Korea. And that could be through North Korea if they, you know, have a tight alliance. I mean, that's not beyond the imagination. It's happened in the Korean War. Or, you know, air and naval assault. I mean, if South Korea is about 100 miles from the Shandong Peninsula, it's about the same distance as Taiwan. So I think U.S. forces are going to be on, should be on the Korean Peninsula. But I think U.S. forces should be focused on China. And, you know, South Korean forces will increasingly as well, but primarily South Korean forces handling North Korea.
Well, on that note, what new defense capabilities and investments around the first island chain should the United States be acquiring?
Well, actually, I mean, there are others who are far more expert on what we need. I mean, David Akmanek or Jim Mitri from the RAND Corporation, Bob Work, former Deputy Secretary of Defense. What I would say is that we should be focusing our forces on a denial defense, which is to say to be able to defeat an invasion, deny the ability of China to seize and hold the key territory of an ally or Taiwan. We should be able to do that in the near term and the long term. So we cannot take a knee for the foreseeable future because the Chinese plausibly have the capability in this decade. We should not bet on, you know, a single point of failure kind of problem where, like, we have one exquisite solution, but if it fails or the Chinese figure out a countermeasure, we're up a creek without a paddle. And we should have a force that combines both the advantages of long-range striking power, you know, which tends to be more sort of decisive from a military point of view and survivable in terms of its basing, but also the political and some military advantages of a forward deployed blunt force, like what the U.S. Marine Corps is doing, which is to say, you know, forces that are there are both present operational and strategic dilemmas for the Chinese and also reinforce the confidence of so-called green, our allies. And so what this adds up to is, like, whether this is the kind of line I use is whether this is done by a slingshot or, you know, a hypersonic missile, I am agnostic about it. I mean, obviously we need new capabilities. What we need is capabilities to strike, particularly against ships and aircraft, very quickly at range, and we need the targeting architecture, C4ISR, if you will, Bob Work calls battle network, both in the atmosphere but also in space, that's resilient, that can take a licking and keep on ticking, and then the ability to sustain that kind of capability over time. I don't tend to take a very strong position about, do we need to, you know, my friend Chris Bros wrote a very important book called The Kill Chain, saying we really need to completely overhaul our forces. Other, you know, my friend Mac Eaglin or others have said we can't afford to divest, invest. I personally don't have a super strong view. I guess I would sort of say I kind of split the baby and say, let's try to do both. But what this means is that we should be taking less risk and allocating more resources and attention to the Western Pacific, because I don't want to like just say, oh, hey, we got ourselves just above the cut line of sufficiency in the Western Pacific, so then we can keep, you know, doing stuff in the Middle East and Europe. No, I want to get way above the cut line so the Chinese don't think they can get away with it, that there's no question that they understand that that's not going to be a good idea for them.
In our conversation today, we've covered a wide range of topics, including capabilities needed in Western Pacific, Taiwan policy, U.S. approach to alliances. And I wanted to switch gears a bit to talk about the ongoing invasion of Ukraine, you know, a significant defense priority of the Biden administration in 2023, I'd imagine. Where do you see the war headed today?
Well, that's a really good question, a very, very, very good question. And I am always a bit chary about opining, just because obviously war is unpredictable, but also there are others who know the Russian military and the Ukrainian military much more than I have. And I'll confess, I've been surprised by the underperformance of the Russians, particularly in the earlier part of the war. That said, I'm increasingly thinking that this war is likely to go on for a long period of time and is likely to kind of be have elements of maneuver, but in essence be an attritional conflict that's unlikely to have a decisive resolution in the near term or even medium term. And part of my reason for saying that is not simply what I'm observing, but clearly the administration is preparing that baseline. I mean, you can see it through repeated leaks or kind of shaping narrative, both to journalists and columnists who are close to the administration. So that Secretary General Stoltenberg said something very similar the other day, and the Russians are adapting, even if they continue underperforming. They're both adapting and mobilizing, as a piece by Dara Massicotte in Foreign Affairs that just came out puts it. So, you know, there's been a lot of fanfare, and I mean, my view is the Ukrainians are fighting a just defense, a just war, and we should support them, consistent with the genuine prioritization of Asia, which I don't think we're doing right now. But I think we also need to be realistic, and that's I think where I would, if I had to bet money, which I'm not, I would bet money on that outcome. But cognizant that, you know, we could be surprised by Ukrainian overperformance, but also by Russian overperformance. So, but that's sort of where I would expect things to go.
The United States sent around $23 billion in military aid to Ukraine last year. The Biden administration is sending Abrams tanks to Ukraine now, and there is some initial talks of Western fighter jets, including the F-16, also being sent to aid Ukraine. Are these, as Ukrainian president said to Congress, an investment in global security and democracy? How much is too much?
I think the number is higher, maybe not necessarily on military aid, but I think the pledge number is closer to $100 billion, as I understand it, including non-military aid as well. I could be wrong. Correct me, please. But so that tells you the scale. So that answers the question at the end, which is American foreign policy should not be about the triumph of democracy in every quarter.
I think we should always support free government and so forth.
Well, they don't necessarily trade off.
That's the George W. Bush, Woodrow Wilson Manichaeanism. That has led us on the shoals so many times before.
Of that,
and now we're dealing with like a nuclear arm, great power, and potentially we've got one, an even stronger one that we could be fighting soon.
And we didn't do that. So, I mean, I'm not king of the country. There is no king of the country. But the closest thing to it, the president of the United States clearly is prioritizing Ukraine. He didn't even mention China in his space. Well, I think barely mentioned China, certainly not with any kind of urgency in his State of the Union. But he spoke with fervency about the Ukraine issue. In terms of what President Zelensky said, I mean, look, I,
I understand where President Zelensky is coming. He's leading a nation that's fighting for survival. But I don't think that the Ukraine is the ultimate test of democracy versus autocracy. I don't even like that frame. I mean, American foreign policy should not be about the triumph of democracy in every quarter. We should always support free government and so forth. But like that's the George W. Bush, Woodrow Wilson Manichaeanism that has led us on the shoal so many times before. And now we're dealing with like a nuclear armed great power, and potentially we've got one, an even stronger one that we could be fighting soon. I think the war in Ukraine is about European security and the threat from Russia and so forth. And, you know, obviously defense of its own territorial integrity and so forth. I think we should support the Ukrainians, but the Europeans should take the lead. I mean, this is consistent with my vision of how we should deal with our allies, which is the countries that care the most about Ukraine and European security are in Europe. And that's the point. I'm reading actually a piece in Foreign Affairs before we started this by Shivshankar Menon, the former National Security Advisor of India, who's pointing out, you know, I mean, like most countries outside of Europe have a different view of the conflict. They might sympathize with Ukraine, but they have more detachment about it because they don't live in Europe, right? It's like, but, you know, our information narrative, and particularly in the transatlanticist kind of world and the world of the last year, it's like, you know, Ragnarok. And I mean, it is an abominable and barbaric attack by the Russians. Yes. But if you're India, you fought multiple wars with Pakistan where, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of people have died and the West kind of looked the other way. I mean, they look back at the 1971 war in our world there, for instance. So I'm not saying that, you know, that's everything's equivalent. To the contrary, my point is we should look at this not primarily through a moralistic lens, but primarily through the lens of what's in the American people's interest. And the administration's own statement is that China is the priority and Taiwan is the pacing scenario. Okay, well, let's act like it, because we're not. And to your point about what's going to happen to the war seems likely to go on. This is true of a lot of Republicans, you know, too, that I don't think are grappling with reality, who are saying we're going to defeat Ukraine and then we're going to pivot to China or whatever, sort of. But like, A, I don't think that's likely to happen based on what I said. B, even if it did happen, are the Russians just going to go away? I mean, didn't we learn anything from the collapse of the Soviet Union? I mean, it's actually worse relations with the Soviet Union than it was at the end of the 1980s that we have now with the Russians. So we have to prepare realistically, soberly, for the most, to go back to where we started, the most dangerous, stressing situation for American foreign policy since, you know, just objectively, in some ways, since the 19th century. And I mean, then it wasn't that dangerous, actually. So possibly ever in our history. And I don't, you know, that's what you may have seen me. I really get lit up about walk and chew gum, the administration's comment about how they deal with this problem. And I just think that's conveys such a lack of seriousness about the scale of the problem. And actually, it's even less tenable from hawk critics of the administration, since, you know, they're always saying we have to be militarily dominant. We can't afford to let our allies get a single step on us. And, you know, we haven't been spending as much as they would like on defense for years. So ergo, there should be some logical consequence of that.
And finally, to conclude and tie this analysis you just laid out about how the current administration and others are balancing the competing priorities that are Asia and Russia-Ukraine, could you explain why can't defending Ukraine have the same effect as defending Taiwan?
Well, I don't think they should be competing priorities. I think the priority is China and Taiwan, but they're not following through on that. The argument that's often proffered for that is that we will deter China from invading Taiwan by defeating Russia and Ukraine. And it's just a profoundly flawed argument. I mean, so much so that I often just don't take it at face value, because I think it's usually tendentious, or often tendentious. But I mean, I don't want to question people's intellectual integrity. But like, you know, if you run out of, you know, or if you use too much, you know, like John Bolton said in an op-ed about this about a year ago, he said military forces are not zero sum. I mean, that's just a laughable claim, right? Like you can't use a missile more than once. You can't use a bullet more than once. A plane, a ship can't be in more than one place. Planes can move, but it can be difficult. Ships take weeks and weeks, right? So the thing that's, if you're thinking about a war, when you think about how it's going to go, yes, you think about the resolve of the opponent, but you really think about like how many stuff does he have available, right? And that's the, so it's like this very sort of
kind of like comic book sort of a sort of assessment of how China's going to behave, and you know that they're going to be look at how we behave in Ukraine in a totally different theater of conflict. I mean, the analogy I use is like that argument. With that argument, we'd still be fighting the Viet Cong, and you know, and we would have lost the Cold War in Europe, right? So, what I would say is, you know, we should grapple with the reality and make sure that China never sees that it could plausibly get away with aggression against Taiwan. And that's largely about, do we have the stuff? Are we ready? Are we in as good a position as possible? And the fundamental problem is we're not where we need to be, and we're not on that trajectory as far as I can tell. So it's not like the status quo is okay and we're kind of managing it with Ukraine. No, the status quo is going to lead us to hit the iceberg, and then we're taking on like a whole nother thing. And that's not a good strategy. It's not a good plan.
Well, Mr. Colby, thank you so much for joining us today on this wide-ranging conversation on the, perhaps seemingly insurmountable challenges our country faces today.
Great, guys. Great to talk to you.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.